You're listening to Feathers, a podcast of stories about God speaking and his people having just enough faith to believe him and obey. I hope these stories inspire you and encourage you to take flight in your own faith.
I'm your host, Amy Bennett, and this is Season 5, Episode 13. Well, hey guys, and welcome to Feathers this week. I'm so excited to have you back today. Today we have Aaron Lochner. Erin is a former stylist in LA and has been blogging and speaking for more than a decade. Her writing and design work has been featured in places like the New York Times, Lucky, Parenting, and Marie Claire, and a two-season HGTV.com web special. Erin and her family are now nestled in a Midwestern town where she still blogs at designformankind.com. Erin and I shared a conversation over her new book, Chasing Slow. And I'll admit, today felt a little bit different conversation than we normally have on this podcast. She shares her journey to what she calls chasing slow. We talk about chasing the American dream and then chasing minimalism and really learning to live in this space where God is in control and we're living in the right rhythm of life. We talk about accepting ourselves with all of our imperfections and learning to extend grace. So our conversation is kind of all over the place. It's a little bit less story-driven today, but I hope that you enjoy it. Erin is about as sweet as they come, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. So here is Erin. Well, hey, Erin, and welcome to Feathers today.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
Yes, I'm so glad that you're here. How about we start off, you introduce yourself and your family and what you do and all the good stuff.
Sure. I am Erin Lochner. I am a writer and stylist in the Midwest. I write at designformankind.com. I've been blogging for about 12 years. And my family is my husband, Ken, and my 4.5-year-old daughter, Bee. And we just adopted a little guy named Scout, who is a 4-month-old teething baby right now. So if I seem sleep deprived, that's why.
So exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a whirlwind.
I was just looking on Instagram and saw, of course, you have the new book, Chasing Slow, out. And at the end of the book, you're talking about adoption. So I had hopped on Instagram to see where you guys, you know, kind of were with that. And it was so exciting to see the Scout was with you. And I was like, oh my goodness, this book coming out and a baby, must be overwhelmed.
Oh, yes. It's been full of lots of good things. Yeah, it's been a very full season. But yeah, I love how everything has just come all the way around. You know, the book ended with the accepting of a lot of question marks. And I feel like God's been really faithful in answering some of those.
Yes. So let's jump into your book. It's just a beautiful book, first of all.
Thank you.
Of course, you are designer, so of course it's beautiful, but the words itself too are beautiful.
You're such
a wonderful storyteller. I love how it's very essay-driven,
mm-hmm.
And yet is weaving a story through that. So just
Thank
beautiful.
Thank you. It was a really fun story to write. It was very challenging. I'm used to writing short form essays, and this was, I really wanted it to read, not in a typical memoir fashion, but in a way that, you know, I know moms are busy and tired and I'm busy and tired. So I wanted it to be, you know, short enough that it's just a little read that you can jump into at the end of the night and nothing too committal. So I think it's a good blend.
Right. Well, I felt like it was one of those things where I love that idea that, you know, just jump into it every night. I felt like it was one of those things where you'd sit down and you read a chapter and felt like you really got kind of a chunk of something without feeling like you were missing the whole rest of everything.
Good.
So let's go ahead and talk about your story. The title of it is Chasing Slow, Courage to Journey Off the Beaten Path. And really, your story starts, well, you start it at when you meet your husband, I believe. But really, I think this idea, you weave this idea of this hunger that you had, that I think we all have, and really started, I guess, in childhood. I'd love for you to talk about that idea of hunger that you kind of wove in there and how that played into, you know, what was going on with your husband.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I was raised in the Midwest, youngest of three girls, so no shortage of emotional issues and complexes and all of the sort. But I feel like I grew up with this existential weight on my shoulders, just wondering, is this all there is, you know? And it's very odd because I grew up in a Christian household. But I didn't feel like I was doing it right. I just always wondered, you know, is this how it should look like? Is this what a Christian should look like? Is this, you know, what a young girl should look like? Is this, I was so curious from such a young age, and I just felt driven by this idea that maybe I wasn't enough, or maybe I wasn't doing things the way I was supposed to be doing them.
Am I doing this right? Yeah.
Yeah. And what is right anyway? You know, I feel like, I was always searching for something outside of myself and outside of God, to be honest. And, I think a lot of us still do that. So I ended up, you know, my solution to that has always been to throw myself into work. I'm a, you know, Midwestern work ethic that'll get you every time. So I met my husband in college. We were filming a documentary, and, we had this incredible, amazing conversation. I basically fell in love with him instantly, which not in a love at first sight way, but just there was a depth to him that I was very drawn to. And then, you know, within that same conversation, he told me that he had a brain tumor. And I remember thinking, well, that's a bummer, because I was going to marry you. It was the first time in my life that I really took ownership over a choice that, you know, yes, every doctor says that you'll have 10 years to live. Yes, that's a shorter lifespan than what I want. Yes, I want to build a life with a man who might not get to see it through, but I'm going to marry you anyway. You know, it was almost as if, for the first time, I was understanding that life is a gift and not a given. You know, there were really very literally no guarantees. And so, we got married, we moved to Los Angeles. And it was the opposite of happily ever after, as you can imagine. I feel like there was so much, you know, being a newlywed is hard. Being a young person is hard. We were really kind of coming into ourselves at the same time. And I think dealing with his diagnosis, we both sort of threw ourselves into different things in processing that. Both of us, I started having panic attacks. I think just from probably just that, the not processing of it all, you know, I really didn't let, I was very almost in denial that he did have the diagnosis that he had. You know, it was almost like I was telling myself, well, if I only have him for today, that's enough, but I wasn't believing it. You know, I wanted more. And, he was throwing himself into work, and we were on very opposite paths. And so part of this journey to slowing down has been slowing down enough to sit with those question marks and to sit with those circumstances that you would not choose in a million years, into letting that be okay. You can be upset about that and angry about that, and at the same time celebrate this wonderful day that you've been given. You know, you can have all of those emotions at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So as you guys are out there and you're feeling these panic attacks, and you're still kind of chasing this though, right? I mean, you're still trying to produce while you're there. So talk about where that kind of led. And really, before we go on, I want to ask, your anxiety and the panic attacks, that lessened while you were still in LA, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So what, I'm just wondering, for people who might be listening that deal with panic attacks and anxiety, what do you think it was that helped? I know in the book you talked about, like, it's kind of a cocktail of things. Mm-hmm. What were the things that helped you?
Well, on a very physical level, self-care was big. You know, I think I would love to say that it was all completely, you know, putting my trust in God alone, and then boom, I was fixed. But I think not fixed in that there's something inherently wrong with you if you have panic attacks, because that's certainly not the case. But in a sense, cured. You know, I thought that I could be cured with that. But it took a lot of self-care. I started exercising a lot more. I drank a ton of water. I changed my diet. I rested. I listened to my body. And those are all things that you know we should be doing. And yet I think it takes carving out some time, and it takes really hitting that rock bottom. It takes your body kind of surprising you to actually do all of those things at the same time. So, I would say it was a combination of, physical changes, and then also a complete surrender, in that it's funny, when you're having panic attacks, you can't control them. You can't talk yourself out of them. There's nothing logical about them. It's just this very, visceral reaction. It's your body sending a red flag saying something isn't right here. And you can't really pick yourself up from the bootstraps and walk out of that situation. Your body has taken over. And there's something really scary about that, and also really freeing about that. I think it's an opportunity to understand we are in far less control than we think that we are. And, you know, I remember a particular portion of the book where I talk about a coworker taking me surfing, and I was terrible at it. It was the worst. I kept falling down and, getting frustrated, and she watched me and was trying to give me pointers. And she said, "Erin, like, what your problem is that you're relying on your own strength, and you're negating the water's movement. You know, you're forgetting that the water is here for you, that it's stronger than you. Just rest in that. Let the wave carry you. Let the wave do the work." And it was such a metaphor for how I had been living, you know, just pushing through so many emotions, pushing through and pushing down. And,
I love just, that, phrase that you say, more, less me, more water. Is that what it, more water, less me.
I would think,
try again this time with less you and more water, I believe was her quote. And I have to tell you, since I've finished this book, I've been saying that to myself. Just because, and I think it's a beautiful metaphor, because I go into the whole productivity control type thing too. And it is, you have to learn to rest in, you know, in our metaphor, it's God and his grace and what he's doing. And it's like when your mind starts going 100 miles an hour, I've been just saying, like, less me, more water.
Yeah. And it really, I think, points to the fluidity of life too, you know, and just, not, you know, in a go with the flow manner. I think we very much need to take ownership over our lives and be responsible for that. But allowing yourself to move with the natural rhythm that God has intended for you. And, you know, I always come back to Proverbs 16:9, where it talks about how, we can make our plans, but the Lord determines our steps. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I feel like we do that, right? Everybody's making plans. You know, we're trying to design our lives perfectly. And I feel like there's no shortage of information that tells you how to, you know, with life hacks and tips, and we're always learning new things. And we're so busy making plans that we forget that the Lord is the one determining our steps. And we're so busy making our pace, but we forget that the Lord determines our direction. And I just think if we do slow down enough to process our life as a whole, and to really reflect on that, doing things with less us and more water, with less us and more God, is absolutely the only way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it took a while for you to learn this process. So let's go back. You're in LA having panic attacks. You begin to kind of come out of that, but you're still kind of chasing, I guess, what you might call the American dream.
Yeah.
So talk about that kind of season of your life.
You know, it's funny. I remember that season. What stands out the most to me is living a season of both my husband and I working all the time, Here we are, these like madly in love newlyweds that never see each other. And I remember just falling into a heap on the floor of our closet in this new beautiful house that we bought, you know, surrounded by this gorgeous whatever. And there's an ocean view, for goodness sakes. Like, why am I not happy? And I don't mean happy in the sense that I wasn't happy in my marriage and that my husband wasn't fulfilling me. I mean, this happiness in my soul, this joy that was not existing for me. And I thought that I had gone through all the motions and that I had done all the, made all the good decisions and the smart decisions. And I had fulfilled what I thought we were supposed to fulfill, which was the American dream. And, it felt like a nightmare. So, Ken and I just, I obviously came home from work very late and found me in the closet of all places. And just, we did some reassessing, you know, we were honest with each other and we had a very raw and vulnerable conversation and decided we needed to either change something or, that we would ruin ourselves. And so we really just started adding a lot of margin into our day, into our time. Ken went through a big change at work. I did the same. We focused less on acquiring, whether that be, you know, more hours at work or acquiring more, you know, clothes for our wardrobe or even acquiring more accolades within the church. You know, we focus less on fluffing our nest with those distractions. And we focused a little more on just stripping away the excess to see what was still there. And, I mean, it surfaced in a lot of very tangible ways. You know, we made time for walks to the dog park and we, you know, would visit the thrift store and we would, cook at home more and sit on the patio with a jigsaw puzzle. Like we were together a lot more, and focused on people rather than things. And all of those, I mean, they were very small shifts and they all kind of just, I think, adhered us to one another again and made us sort of reassess what our path in life was supposed to be looking like.
Well, isn't the question you guys were really asking is like, what is enough, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
You kind of on this train of going to get the most you can, work the hardest you can, have, you know, the best house, you know, and whatnot. And then you have to step back and say, what really is enough?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You're totally right. Yes. And it's, and only we can answer that. And we must answer that. Like we must just decide now, no matter your circumstances, that you have enough. Like I had just always thought that it would, you know, I would magically see what I had as, there, that's better. Like, there we are. We're good now. We've got everything we need. And that never does our brain naturally condition itself to do that. I think we have to make that a conscious choice and just decide, okay, I'm taking myself out of the running. I'm done here. Like this is good. This is enough. We are great. And now comes the hard part of saying no to everything else and of attempting to not fall back into that pattern of acquiring and of doing and of being productive and of striving and thriving in your own power.
Right. And I think that happens with, like you said, with a lot of different things. I think it happens with work. I think it happens with how many clothes you have. It happens with a lot of things. Like, how much do I need to work to make my life work? How many clothes do I need to actually clothe myself? Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to get into that trap of more is better.
Absolutely.
If this is enough, then more is obviously going to be better. But at some point, you can just say, you know what? This is enough. This, you know, I only need to work this number of hours because I only need to work that many number of hours to support what is enough, like in my clothes, in my house, and in my car, mm-hmm. and all that. I think you're so right, though. It's not natural. Like, you're not going to get to a point and say, you know, your brain doesn't say enough. Like, you have to consciously look around and say, what kind of life do I want to live, and what does enough mean for me?
Absolutely. Yes. And it's so funny. We are just hardwired to you know, spend our days working for more hours to buy more things we don't need that we don't get to enjoy because we're at work. You know, it's just,
exactly.
It's just like, and we do it with everything. We do it with, you know, plans for our children and, expectations. You know, we are always requiring and asking for more than what we need. And I think it's really, it's been freeing to get to a place of, gratitude for what is, and not even gratitude in the thankful sense, but just, the choice that, no, I'm cutting it off. I am perfectly fine here. I am good. Like, nothing is in question here. My worth is not in question. I will not receive more self-worth from this new sofa. I will not receive more self-worth. I will not be valued anymore if my children are better behaved. You know, it's, our identity is not in question. It is in God. So I think when that shift happens is when we can kind of appreciate the freedom to say we are already enough. We don't need more.
So one of the big turning points, I think it seemed to me for you, kind of in this sort of life, was a trip to Ethiopia.
Yes.
And I was so excited to read this part of your book because I actually followed your trip, but I was following it because I was a fan of Emily Maynard.
Oh,
and Shannon Martin has actually been on the podcast too. So, yeah, it's so exciting that you went on a trip with them. So tell me about that and how that kind of played into your story too.
Well, it was an incredible trip. Absolutely. I feel like, you know, we as humans are hardwired to, we're very adaptable, and that's a great thing. And that's a really not great thing. And that we tend to adapt to our surroundings. And so certainly by American standards, you think, well, gosh, like I see all of these people around me that can afford this and can afford this and are working this hard for this thing. And, it's all around you, and it just kind of seeps in. I think our very consumer society. And I think it's natural to think that as many steps as you take toward minimalism in your life, there's always more excess to be stripped away. I think spiritually, emotionally, physically, all of it. And in going to Ethiopia and seeing the joy, and the hardship that these women were facing, and how their joy was completely detached from their circumstance. They taught me everything about worth. They taught me, everything about beauty. You know, I remember just, we painted each other's nails, at one point. We did like the typical coffee ceremony, and everyone was roasting beans and painting each other's nails. And, it's kind of a beautiful thing to have that language barrier because you find yourself smiling so much more, you know, you can't explain things with words. And sometimes that's the most beautiful way to explain something. So is with a smile. And, so we were kind of just exchanging these like beauty rituals, from culture to culture. And it just, I realized actually on the flight home, as I saw my polish had already been chipping away, that, that was a metaphor for sort of how my life was going at the moment. I just felt this real chipping, this slow chipping of, what I thought was important and what I thought was need and what I thought was more. And, how I had had it wrong. You know, I feel like it's very easy to, especially in the online world, I think it's very easy to assume that you are just not enough. You are just not doing enough or buying enough or, parenting enough, or you can always be a better wife. There's always ways to do everything better. And, here are these women who, by our measurement, you know, by our so skewed measurement, are lacking in things. and are just overflowing with joy. And it was everything that the Bible says is true. It was just a slap in the face that, well, the Bible didn't lie about this. God was absolutely right. And that, you know, blessed are those with less. And well, what does that mean for those of us that keep wanting and chasing more?
So I love this quote that you had after that experience. And you say, ask a bird how to fly, and it might tell you to remove the weight from your wings. So, this is where you kind of begin this process of removing the weight. But I think it's so interesting that, so you begin to, you know, chase low, and we've kind of talked about that in all sorts of ways, but that you can fall into a trap of chasing slow can actually be just as exhausting. It's not
fun. Yeah. Yes. And that was so interesting to learn for me. And it's funny because you're right. I did shortly after that trip. And I've kind of always had a bent toward minimalism, but this trip, I think, was the first time I was doing it for my heart and not just to declutter my home. It was, okay, well, what will happen if I sit with some emptiness for a little bit? What will happen if I stop fluffing my nest and, you know, padding my insecurities with that new eye cream and that new, amazing bra, you know, whatever, what will happen? You know, what would come of that? And this was the first time that I really wanted to bring to see if I could allow more room for more joy if I stopped distracting myself with things. And, what happened was, So around this time is when I started writing a book about slow living and kind of my journey in doing that. And I thought I would get to this nice, tidy arrival point in my slow living journey. And I would realize, okay, well, now I've got it. And the book would be tied up with a beautiful bow. And in reality, what I found was I wrote this book in 6 months, which was very, by every definition, a fast way to write that book. And there was a lot of takeout from styrofoam containers. There was a lot of, toddler tantrums and mother tantrums. And I was living in a very fast season while writing about living a slow life. And I felt so hypocritical. And I realized all I had been doing was shifting the metric. You know, I shifted the metric from glorifying the fast life and the American dream to now glorifying the opposite of it, which was the slow life and the simple life. And I had begun measuring myself by that yardstick instead, but it's still a measurement. You know, it's still a metric. I feel like we can con Mari within every inch of our lives. But if we're using that as a value based metric to determine our self-worth, you know, if we're using it to control and manipulate our life so that we look and feel a certain way, then we're still idolizing that just as much as we are the fast life. Mm-hmm. And that is what this book is about. That's the book I ended up writing. I was supposed to write a book about glorifying slow living. I wrote a book about how we can't glorify any pace at all. That's not what we're meant to be doing.
So what does life look like since then? I love one of the quotes towards the end of the book where you're beginning to figure this out. You know, you're letting go of the, you know, one idol. You've grabbed another idol, and then you're going to let go of both. And you call that surrender. And I love when you talk about, you always thought that the opposite of surrender would be chaos, or the opposite of control would be chaos, but it's actually surrender. So what does that kind of life look like?
Well, I feel like the goal now has been less, kind of that less of the attempting to control everything. And not even in a behavioral sense, but in a just in the small ways that we as women, are so we're very sensitive, complex creatures. And I think I often confuse taking ownership and responsibility over my life with taking control over my life. So what that looks like is, you know, if I'm feeling the blues, I'll turn on my playlist and I'll, you know, light a candle and bring in some sunlight, open the windows, you know, all of these things, which are great. And I used to rely on those quite often to kind of give me a pick me up and a boost. And those are all good and worthy activities and behaviors, I think, to infuse a little joy in your life. But what I've been trying to do now is to kind of sit with that discontent and that discomfort a little longer, and to stretch myself to try and rise above those circumstances without any of the tools, you know, without any of the candle lighting and the put on my happy music, you know, and to just sit with those feelings of discontent that surface every now and then, and to unpack them. It's really hard to do when your baby is screaming and your toddler's like dumping Cheerios everywhere. So it's a practice and a process, but I feel like that's where the learning happens. It's not in the covering up and in the diffusing and in the distraction. It's in the allowing yourself to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, and that to allow yourself, to kind of flow through your circumstances without all that extra help. And that's not to dismiss the wonderful ways I think that we do boost ourselves throughout the day. I mean, I'm a firm believer in a great red lipstick every now and then. So I don't want to Pollyanna or airbrush the topic either, but I do, I feel like we live such comfortable lives that a little stretching is necessary to prepare us for the big stretches that are inevitable, you know, for when, if we can get in the process and in the practice of being uncomfortable more often, we will be better prepared for, you know, the inevitable and the unexpected and the surprises and, you know, sick kids and aging parents and sadness and suffering, and all of those things that life brings regardless.
Well, I think so often we try to make our life so comfortable, like anything that's going to cause us pain or, awkwardness or anything, we just run from. And I think that's so important that, you know, I don't think God calls us to a life of comfort.
No.
I think facing the pain is really important, facing the grief, whatever it is. And I love how you talk about in your book, and I think what I got towards the end and where you landed is really that we're finding our identity, not in our circumstances, but in God, but taking our whole self, you know, the good and the bad and the non-perfection and everything and all these places that we do feel pain, and being okay with that. And I think that's, you know, from a perfectionist, that's hard, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Being okay with, like what you call the cracks. Mm-hmm. But those are really the points of beauty in a lot of ways. Tell me about the, oh gosh, it's the pottery, and I don't remember what the name of it is.
Oh, kintsugi.
Yes.
Yes. It's a Japanese technique. Oh my gosh. This was just, my friend Mai was telling me about it. And it's just an old Japanese ritual where, you know, if a mug breaks or a bowl, you know, anything ceramic or porcelain in nature, you repair it, yes, but instead of repairing it with that typical, you know, invisible clear glue, they gild it and they fill it with gold because it brings beauty to that broken spot. It highlights that brokenness, and it adds character and depth and wisdom and perspective. And I feel like our culture is the opposite of, you know, we glorify effortless and we glorify anyone without any cracks, you know, don't let the cracks show and use concealer and cover up and, wrinkle cream, you know, and just anything that can, you know, airbrush the pain and the suffering away or the imperfections away. And I buy into this all the time. I probably have 3 pairs of Spanx. So it's such a human way to go about things. But I love the perspective of, I don't think highlighting our imperfections means airing our dirty laundry and lowering the bar, but I think it's about accepting the complexities and the contradictions in your own life and saying, that's okay. Like, this is the process and this is, one of the cracks. It doesn't mean it's broken. It means it can be repaired. And how beautiful is that?
Yeah. And I like to, and I love how you talked about grace, and I think that's really where grace kind of comes in. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, you talk about, you know, God's version of grace, and, you know, it's to say, you know, you did this wrong, you get a free pass. You know, that's what we want to say.
Yeah.
But really, you know, you did this wrong and God's paid for that. It wasn't free at all. And to be grateful for that. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Hopefully I said that right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, I did. I always operated under the mentality that, you know, you did this wrong, but you did this right. And, grace meant giving yourself a free pass or giving someone else a free pass. But it's really that, yeah, giving yourself a free pass, but realizing that I wasn't free at all. And I think that's the part that we miss, is the realizing it wasn't free at all. And then going forth in that, and then loving others in that same realization that the price has already been paid. And how can we show gratitude for that? In loving someone else and in loving ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think when we have that, I think that's when those cracks become beautiful and we can accept others and their cracks because they have grace, because God, you know, God paid for that. Christ paid for that already. And I can come with my whole self because Christ has already paid. And, you know, in those cracks, imperfections, that's where we do get the wisdom. That's where we, you know, that's where we grow.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And in those contradictions, especially, I feel like I've always had a fear of being a hypocrite. I think
yes,
probably too, because, I work online. And so I'm always very, you know, I want to be honest and I want to be vulnerable, but I also think it's wise to err on the side of privacy as well, and to protect the stories of the people in your life and the people you love. And so I've always just really, I've wanted to be very honest about the fact that I curate a lot of contradictions. And that's always been so hard, because I like things to be tidy and neat and understandable and as simple and non-complex as possible. You know, and I always thought that being a hypocrite meant you were a bad person. And I always equated the two things. But everyone has so many layers and layers of intricate, deep, complex contradictions. You know, it just is. It's how we are made. And I think negating that and dismissing that and trying to attempt to live your life as though you had no contradictions does not allow you to accept other people's contradictions. And it just makes us hypercritical of every time we see someone behaving in a way that doesn't align with their values, which is life, right? That's what we all do. None of us live a life 100% according to our values. And we can strive for that for sure. But I think in identifying those contradictions and learning from them, that's the beauty, instead of dismissing them completely and pretending like, no, like, I'm just going to keep justifying this behavior because I don't want to be a hypocrite.
Yes. I think this is such a struggle. I think especially it does get highlighted online. You talk a lot about, you know, just online is like black and white, you know. You know, people want to identify themselves as in some sort of camp. Like, I'm in the, you know, even minimalistic camp, or I'm in, you know, XYZ camp. And then when you are a human and you actually veer out of that, it can leave you feeling very hypocritical. But I, you know, I love what you say. It's like, we're not either ors, we're both ands.
Yes.
And to accept ourselves for that. And it's not to say, you know, if that's a if you have a certain value, not to chase after that, but to, and again, I think it goes back to grace, giving ourselves grace too, but just accepting ourselves as humans.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And others as well.
Yes. Yeah. Because if you can't accept yourself, you're not going to be able to accept others in the same way either. So, yeah.
And why not practice on, I feel like, why not practice on other people? And then you'll learn how to do it for yourself. You know, I just feel
that's interesting.
Yeah. Practicing offering grace to other people has really allowed myself to learn how to do it to myself.
Because I had the mindset, if I, you know, do yourself first and then you can accept others. But you're suggesting offering that to other people and then we can learn how to do that for ourselves. Because I think if you think about it, we know ourselves more than we know anybody else. So it's probably harder to accept the complexities because we understand the complexities of ourselves so much better.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I'm really good at giving other people grace. I'm really good at giving strangers grace. Mm-hmm. And really bad about, it's almost like the closer I am to you, the harder it is. And so I am definitely the hardest person to give grace to for myself.
I've never thought about it that way. That's really good. Okay. Well, I have so enjoyed our time together. I just scratched the surface on we didn't even get to talk about your HGTV show or blogging. I've been blogging since 2002, so we could probably talk just a long time about blogging in general.
Yes. We'll have to do it another time.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks so much for being here. If people want to connect with you, tell us again how we can connect online and find your book.
Yes. Online, I am at my blog at designformankind.com. And I'm also on Instagram and Twitter fairly often at Erin Lochner. And then the book is out January 10th, and it's called Chasing Slow. It'll be on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, basically anywhere you can buy books.
All right. Well, thanks again so much for being here, Erin.
Thank you for having me, Amy. It's a pleasure.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Erin, and I hope you get to pick up her book, which, of course, shares so much more of her story. It's so interesting. But I think what it boils down to me, though, is learning to find our identity in Christ. You know, God offers us so much grace, and we are valuable to Him just as we are, despite our imperfections, despite our mistakes. He is the great Redeemer who works everything together for good. And I love that Erin has traveled the hard road to find that chasing more and more and more isn't what satisfies, and yet the minimalistic life can be an empty pursuit, too. But it's really about following God for the path He has for us and recognizing the places He's directing us. I think it's such a good reminder as we're starting off this new year that we can organize ourselves and trim down, or we can be on the opposite end and want to chase more. But ultimately, what we need to be doing is running hard after God and all that He has for us. All right, guys, that is it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week on Feathers.